The town may be kind of small, but these folks have big smiles and big hearts. And they know what it is to have simple fun down our way, where old-fashioned singing and homey gatherings make living mighty pleasant.
That's all people know you for. I mean, Gary Glitter, does anybody know anything other than Rock and Roll Part 1? You know?
Wasn't he involved in pedophilia?
Oh, yeah. Was that an album or just a...
Hey, Troy.
Welcome to Abandoned Albums, the documentary podcast where we take a closer look at some albums that may have been forgotten about over time, and some albums you may not even know existed. I'm your host, Keith R. Higgins, and riding shotgun with me is Rob Janicki.
Hey, Keith, how are you?
You know, Rob, thanks for asking. I'm going to go ahead and dig into my bag of quotes here and pull out one from Prince. Music is music, ultimately. If it makes you feel good, cool. And I feel good today because we are talking about some very good music.
But what worries me even more is the way she goes out dancing at these juke joints. She's got nothing in her head but boys, boys, boys.
On this episode of Abandoned Albums, Jeff Murphy from the band Shoes stops by Thunderlove Studios to have a chat with us about that band's 1979 major label debut, Present Tense. Shoes began to get some attention after their 1977 DIY full-length album, Black Vinyl Shoes, made its way into the ears of such tastemakers like Ira Robbins from New York's Trouser Press and Robert Christgau from The Village Voice. Not surprisingly, they started getting courted by major labels. However, in the end, it would be Elektra Records that would sign Shoes and then whisk them off to London to record their debut album with producer Mike Stone. The result was Present Tense, released in 1979. An amazing record that managed to climb up the Billboard album charts almost as fast as it fell off. So here's me and Rob and Jeff Murphy at Thunderlove Studios in the present tense. First of all, I gotta say I love that record. I had never heard it until 2-3 weeks ago. And I've just been listening to Present Tense. I've probably listened to it at least a dozen times all the way through.
Oh, thank you.
I'm embarrassed and ashamed to say I've never heard it before, but wow.
Well, you know, someone asked me a couple of years ago, they said, sort of sarcastically, I guess, they said, don't you think you've reached all the fans you're ever going to reach? And I said, no, that's the wonderful thing about music is it's there forever. The song that Apple is using in their new commercials is a song that Sparks did called This Town Ain't Big Enough for the Both of Us.
Oh.
And I think that was done in 1974, which I love it. I love when things get discovered after the fact. And my analogy is, if I ask you, what do you think of ZZ Top? You probably have an opinion one way or the other. Or if I say, what do you think of Aerosmith or Fleetwood Mac or whatever, you probably have an opinion one way or the other. But if I ask most people what they think of Shoes, they would give me a blank stare. And that, to me, is a potential new set of ears.
For sure.
You know, and to me, that's what music is. It is a timeless art form. I mean, the production can timestamp it, but present tense was probably one of the least timestamped records that we did.
You always seem to be ahead of the curve technologically, you know, even going back to the onset of the band. Where does that come from?
Gary and I always loved technology, and I had a tape machine, which I documented in that book, that I think I was 8 years old. I was fascinated not only by the electronics of being able to record something and play it back later, but you could screw around with it, speed it up, slow it down, and the electromechanical aspect of it. You know, I love gadgets. I love the reels, seeing the reels go around, and that carried into adulthood, where I miss the analog aspect of seeing real meters, you know, bouncing and the lights in this. We talked about this the other day. I can't remember who I was talking to. Mark Caro, who's a writer from Chicago. I was talking to him last week, and I mentioned the fact that it used to be when you went into a studio, you could tell what brand tape they had by the smell, because every brand had a distinctive odor because of the adhesive that they used for the recording tape. And I miss that. You know, a smell is a very powerful reminder of history, of your history. And he said to me, you know, it's weird. I just talked to Mitch Easter, and he said the same thing. I said, well, yeah, I guess all us guys that worked on analog, we have that, you know, in the back of our brain, we have that tucked away.
It's interesting that you mentioned Mitch Easter, because Rob and I were talking earlier, Rob in particular, how much he heard of present tense in bands like REM. And, you know, Mitch Easter produced the first two records by them, and just how much that record and your sound seemed to influence those bands that came after you.
We met Mitch a couple of different times and talked to him. And it's like old war buddies, you know, even though you weren't seeing each other every day, you know, you speak the same language because you experience the same what do you want to call it? Internship, I guess you say.
Sure.
You have to understand the way that our band started was somebody once told us years ago, but years after the fact of being signed to a major label and doing all that, they said, you guys were too dumb to know that you couldn't do it. We just put our heads down and said, wouldn't it be cool to have a band? Wouldn't it be cool to learn how to play instruments and record and be on the radio? So that was our goal. And we still don't consider ourselves musicians. We're songwriters and producers and arrangers. We hear something, we get an idea for something, go, oh, I know what to do. And then you learn how to play it somehow. And we were in our own little cocoon in this little dry community of Zion, Illinois, which had no music scene whatsoever.
So if there was no music scene there, where did you go for your music scene?
The nearest club was probably 15 miles away, 10 miles. But it was the stomping grounds of Cheap Trick. I saw them shortly after Robin joined the band. And I saw them at the club. I went out with my then girlfriend, and I came home and I said to John and Gary, you got to go see these guys. They're head and shoulders above everything else that's happening in the clubs right now. And they became to us the most exciting live thing that we were seeing in clubs. It inspired us to want to strap on the guitars and get out there and do some shit. I mean, of course, we're nowhere near as animated as Rick was, as good looking as Robin or Tom Peterson.
You guys were never much for touring, were you?
We probably played a couple hundred times, you know, over the years, but not like Cheap Trick doing 260 shows a year or something.
Built to be the most distinctive car on the road, with no trace of look-alike styling.
When we did Black Vinyl Shoes in 1977, we released it in 1977, it opened up a whole world to us that we just didn't know, that there were people like Mitch recording on their own, or the guys in the Nerves, you know, making these things on their own like we were. We thought, we felt a real kinship to them and to that whole idea of doing things yourself.
You mentioned you guys, you know, you said you didn't consider yourselves musicians, but I think maybe some of that comes from the fact that you were so much into the gear. And it even, you can look at it like bands today, or I mean, they're not so much today anymore, but, you know, say like Trent Reznor from Nine Inch Nails, right? Just he dove head first into how things work, how sounds are created, how you put it together, even early hip hop with sampling and things like that. So your creativity, you know, a lot of people who do that, to me, it always comes from the fact that they're so much into how stuff is made, how it works, why sounds come out, and then you turn that into music. So don't shortchange yourself because, you know, just because you may have started that way and then played instruments, well, it's all one and the same. The sounds are created equally.
Emmett Rose, his first two albums are just fantastic examples of that home recorded, one guy doing that kind of pop, power pop thing. Now, power pop is, I shouldn't use that term, I guess. You know, that's become a coat hanger for people to hang musical styles on. To me, again, when we grew up, everything that they played on the radio, especially AM radio, was called pop music. And, you know, everything fell in that category. As things got more aggressive through the years with rock music, they sort of divvied it up. You know, metal became, okay, if you're doing Black Sabbath or Metallica or whatever, that's metal. And people would say, then people started calling us power pop. And I said, well, it's nice to be part of any club, I guess, but it's very limiting when they call you something, because no band is completely one thing or the other. For instance, I think Foo Fighters are power pop. I think that band from Australia, Jet, is power pop. I think Fleetwood Mac is power pop. More so the Lindsay stuff. But even a band like the Beatles, who were probably considered the epicenter of power pop music, a song like Michelle is not a power pop song. Pop, sure. But that's just it. Most bands weave in and out of it. With us, we just did the music that we liked, that we thought was missing from the radio, that we wanted to hear more of ourselves. We wanted other bands. We want to find more bands like Fountains of Wayne. You know, we love that stuff. And I remember when we first met those guys, we were talking to them backstage, and I think it was Adam that said, you know, the New York press compares us to you guys.
You're high above California's Mojave Desert. You're watching the end of an unusual test.
As you guys were talking, it reminded me of a conversation Keith and I had earlier. I like how you position the idea of talking to fans who might not have heard of your band or, you know, maybe the early records, using that as a way to, you know, get new fans. And the way I listen to music, and I'll hear something for the first time and I hear influences. I just do. But I heard, you know, a little bit of the Birds. And obviously some of the other, and then from the British side of things, I've heard that. But then I immediately went to bands like REM and what became alternative music. And that to me is fascinating. And now I'm a fan because I identified with that other music from the mid to late 80s. And I can see a direct line back to you guys. But I guarantee you some of those bands talk about you guys and use your records as influence to them. And they were probably saying to their friends, hey, you might not have heard of Shoes, but you know what? Check this record out. It's amazing. This is why we sound this way, or something like that.
It's astounding to us that we would influence anybody. But there's a band, they were out of Texas, called Hyperbubble. And it's a guy and his wife, and they do sort of electronica takes on different songs. And they do original stuff, but then they'll do these cover projects too. And he contacted us because he told us the story of how he discovered Shoes. And he said, the reason I'm doing what I'm doing is because when I was a kid,
I was riding my bike to guitar lessons. The school was just a few miles away from my house, but halfway there, I forgot if it was to the right or to the left. And I wound up in back of a Warner Electra Atlantic warehouse, totally by accident. So I rode into the back of the parking lot to take a closer look and saw what looked like records on the ground. I couldn't believe my eyes. I had struck gold. I didn't realize it at the time, but I was about to participate in my first dumpster dive, and my life would never be the same again. Inside the dumpster, I found a lot more than records and tapes. I found memos, contracts, demos, sales reports, marketing campaigns, and press kits. I found trade publications that discussed my favorite bands, not in terms of words and music, but in terms of units, points, demographics, market shares, branding, target audiences, and crossover potential. I also salvaged two albums that totally changed my outlook on the music biz. One of the albums I took home was by a recording artist who went by the name of M. M had a number one hit with a self-produced synth-pop single called Pop Music. But it was finding an album by a band called Shoes that really turned my head around. First, I couldn't understand how an album this great could be just thrown away, but even more important was finding out that Shoes' previous album was not only recorded by the band in their living room, but also released by the band on their own record label. And I thought it was better sounding than the major label album with all the fancy production. I learned more that day in the dumpster than all of my guitar lessons put together. The curtain on The Wizard of Oz had been lifted. DIY was the way to go.
That little clip, which he does a kind of a cartoon version of him discovering this, he just posted it up on Facebook over the weekend. And he says, I hope someday somebody will discover my music in a dumpster.
So then ultimately, Jeff, how did you end up getting signed by Elektra, and who signed you?
The guy that signed us had never signed a band before. He was the promo kid from Detroit, and he helped break the Cars because of his promotional acumen. So he decided he wanted to be the A&R guy. So he flew to New York to find out what's the word on the street, what's going on, and the reissue, the relicensing that we had done for the Black Vinyl Shoes album had recently come out. And one of the local promo guys had been in Bleecker Bob's in New York, and they were playing Black Vinyl Shoes in store at the time. And he said, who is this? What is this? And he took that album into this guy, and he was the vice president of promotion. He wasn't an A&R guy, but he took us in, and we became a bargaining chip for him. When we signed our deal, I remember one of our lawyers said to us, most bands think this is the finish line. And all this is letting you in the door to now you can play the game. That doesn't mean you've accomplished anything. You haven't gotten the brass ring yet. So we were always waiting for the other shoe to drop.
It seemed to me you guys got and maintained a lot of control. You were able to co-produce the record. I would imagine at the time what you guys were able to get and take hold of and keep control of was kind of contrary to business practices. So I'm curious, is one, am I correct in thinking that? And two, how did you do that?
You are correct. And the wonderful thing, we had a lot of great things that happened to us around that time. One of them was right after we finished, before we signed Present, and did Present Tense, before we signed with Elektra and did the whole major label thing, there was an entrepreneur that owned a record store in California named Greg Shaw. And he had this company called BOMP, B-O-M-P. And he had a great set of ears. He was very intuitive. He knew good music. And he contacted us. He was not a great businessman, but he was there. He found 2020. He found the Romantics. He found us. He signed them all to his label to do a single. And when he asked us to do a single, he said, who does your publishing? And we said, well, what's publishing? And he explained it to us. And he said, there's two ways you can do it. You can give it to me and I'll put it through my company. And then we split that money. My company gets half and then you guys get half. Or this friend of mine named Dan Burgoyce has a company called Bug Music. And they have a totally different business model. And that business model is you start your own publishing company. You own the copyrights and everything. You just hire them to do your paperwork, your administration. And instead of taking half, 50%, they take 15% of your total. And you own the copyrights. So we did that for that first single. And then when Elektra came knocking and they said, we'd like to get the rights to your songs, we said, oh, we already have our publishing set up. So they left us alone, and we not only did we get 100% of the publishing, but which is unusual. When you sign a major label deal, what they'll usually ask for is a preferred rate or a discount rate, and the pay is 75%. We got 100% full royalty, and instead of most albums, if you've noticed over the years, have gone to 10 songs, and that's because the label would say, we're only going to pay you publishing on 10 songs. Put as many on as you want. We're only paying for 10. Our contract, we negotiated that they had to pay for 12 songs. We wanted to do 12 songs because that was, you know, our American version of albums were 12 songs. And because we had this, I don't want to call it a track record because that's too arrogant. But because we were starting to get some attention from the press because of our earlier DIY releases, there started to be a bit of a feeding frenzy, and labels were contacting us. And we had a standing offer from Capitol. Whenever you're done negotiating with Elektra, come to us and we'll beat it. So it was a choice that we had to make. And Elektra, to sweeten the pot, created this side letter. And the side letter said that if any of our music goes out of print after 5 years, the rights to relicense those revert back to the band. So we got our masters back, and we started our own CD company in 1987 because Elektra decided, you know, they, because, you know, record companies, they're like revolving doors, you know, the people get fired and all that. And that started happening right after we finished the second record, going into the third. So when we finished the third album and the company kind of fell apart, they still owed us an album. So they actually had to buy us out of the contract, which was, you know, just crazy. I mean, it was just, that was our major label experience. But recording Present Tense was the absolute pinnacle of our involvement with a major label, because of all these things, we were able to negotiate. Look, our manager went in, because we hired Dan Burgoyce, the guy that set up our publishing. We hired him to do our management too, because he was the nicest guy and very smart, very honest, and a Midwestern guy. And when we went to England, he said, look, these guys know what they're doing. They got records out on their own already. They're releasing, they know how to record. Just leave them alone. That was part of the reason we went to England. Not only was it, you know, going to the fatherland, you know what I mean? It's like, oh my God, this is where the Beatles. It was, you know, we mixed that Trident. It was a dream come true. And going to England was partly that, partly a way to keep the record company from interfering, because, you know, if you're recording in L.A., they're going to stop by with their girlfriends and a case of beer, and they're going to hang out in the studio. And we didn't want that. And the other thing was the producer that we decided on, because we interviewed a ton of people for producing that record with us. We liked Mike Stone because we got along. He had a great sense of humor, which is really important to us. And he was English, and he told us about The Manor, which is where we ended up recording. Some people would call it a castle, but it really was a hunting lodge. And on 100 acres in the English countryside outside of Oxford.
I saw the pictures. Beautiful.
All female staff. Cordon Bleu chef came in and made dinner every night. I mean, it was like, come on. We came out of Zion, Illinois. I'd never been on an airplane before.
Major label stories we hear, and not just doing the podcast, but I mean, if you're a fan of music, and you know, I think we all kind of geek out on music in our own way, read all the interviews, watch all the documentaries. I know I certainly do. You never hear a story of a major label, you know, success almost in terms of how well you were able to navigate all those pitfalls that usually happen, you know, in terms of royalties, publishing, you know, the way they treated you and the way you were able to deal with them. That's pretty amazing. I mean, at the time, did you realize how good it was? Or now looking back is when you realize?
We would talk to other guys. Yeah, we would talk to other bands when we'd run into them, and they would say, oh man, our label sucks. We can't get any money and all this. The least expensive budget that we had was for the first album. Each budget got larger with each album. And we never had a budget that was less than six figures. And anything that we didn't spend, we got to keep. So, you know, if we came in $30,000 or $40,000 under budget, that was money in our pocket. But
amazing.
We learned pretty quick that the record companies had this attitude that, well, if it sounds this good for 50,000, it'll sound three times as good for 150,000. And they wanted us to spend that money. They didn't want to see us walk home with that money. They wanted to see it spent. So we did. You know, we present tense was the cheapest album that we did for the label. Because when we went to England to do it, it was $2,000 a day, which included unlimited recording time because you're staying at the studio. It included all your meals, all your lodging, and there was an all-female staff there that cooked you the meals besides the dinner that was the Cordon Bleu chef. That was all included. And they would say to us, hey, if you got some friends back home, fly them out, let them hang out here and have the meals and, you know, I mean, and just hang.
I have to be honest with you, Robin, I did the math on this earlier, and the $2,000 a day, just figure it was 4 weeks, that's what, $14,000 a week. In today's dollars, that roughly equates to about $280,000.
Really? I remember these, and at the time, you know, it's a lot of money, but at the time it was all part of doing business. I remember my brother John saying, oh my God, this is what it's going to be like from this point on. This is how life is going to be. And it was just so much fun. You felt secure for the first time in your life. You felt secure to make music that you were comfortable doing it.
What do you think may have happened that caused Present Tense to sort of hit a wall commercially, like as far as sales go?
They signed us, so we were teacher's pet, because the head of promotion is the guy that signed us. But now he starts lobbying to become the head of A&R. So he's not going in the office to do his job because he's trying to make a point. Look how important I am. Look how much I knew. I got you the shoes. I found you shoes. Now make me head of A&R. And that was all kind of going down during the promotion of Present Tense when it was still going up the chart. And suddenly, you know, things, the brakes kind of got slammed on because he said, no, I'm not going to go in the office because I want A&R. So he eventually became head of A&R, and things kind of got dicey for us after that, as usually happens when you lose your big champion. I mean, we still were important to him, but it was other people making those promotion decisions after that. The problem was, in our first meeting after we finished the Present Tense album, we flew back from England with it. We sat down with the entire staff from Elektra, all the heads of the departments, in the conference room. And they do their big playback thing, you know, and it becomes this cheer, this pep rally, you know, and everybody's like so excited. And the chairman of the board from Warner Brothers, who's Joe Smith at the time, he said, we expect this album to sell between 3 and 4 million copies, which was the kiss of death. Because now you have this, I mean, come on, how many bands sell 1 million records on their first release? I mean, it just doesn't happen. Very, very rarely. And if you do, you're one of the chosen few. But you have now established a level of expectation. And when it doesn't do that, it disappoints. And that's what we experienced was the great support we had from them. They could not decide what song to release as a single because everybody liked a different song, which as a bunch of songwriters, we were thrilled to death. That's what we wanted to do, was make a record. You know, we didn't want to have an album like The Knack, which we actually, that all happened while we were in England. So we didn't find out about it till we came home. But, you know, if you say, hey, The Knack are doing a tour, what are you going to do? You're going to hang around and hear that one song, My Sharon, which is a great song. And then they're going to go get a beer or something. You know what I mean?
Treated me so wrong.
rock and roll and brothers kind of have an interesting history. Did you and your brother, did you get along? Was it a...
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the John and I, when we were little kids, our dad left. Our dad deserted us when we were young. I was 7 and John was 8, and my dad went to work one day and never heard from him again. Never showed up, just disappeared. Took the car, gone. See you later. And I think that bonded us in a way that is, you know, you tend to cling together.
How did growing up in a community as small as Zion influence your music? Or did it?
It was all about Chicago radio. I mean, we could hear back then, I mean, before FM became a deal, which would have been like 1968. But before that, we were, you know, and every red-blooded kid in our neighborhood that we were exposed to lived by the two AM stations out of Chicago, the two rock AM state, which were WLS and WCFL. And they were very competitive, and you heard it was so exciting because they would play, you know, Motown, then they would play the Beatles, then they would, you know, British Invasion, then they would play something from San Francisco, something from Philadelphia, and the top 10 changed every day. So we would take our transistor radios and put them under our pillow and listen and try to guess what the number one song was going to be that day. You know, is it going to be the Beatles or is it going to be the Supremes or whatever? And now, I mean, you can not turn your radio on for 10 years and turn it back on and be playing the same stuff. It's so sad. I feel bad for the people that will never have that experience that we did. You had to run to keep up. There was this constant flow of new. It was so invigorating.
How do you think the expansion of FM radio impacted you?
FM radio started in the late 60s and early 70s. That's what we were in tune to, but we were always, I don't want to say ahead of the curve, but I remember when John brought home, my brother was kind of our musical compass. He always read interviews and reviews and Rolling Stone and Crawdaddy and Cream and all these different publications. And we were into, I guess you would say, underground albums, like Love, Forever Changes. The average Joe Blow on the street didn't know what that was. We did. You know, in 1968, we were listening to that album, and we were listening to Earth Opera. Even after we signed with Elektra, we'd go to a radio station, and they would ask us, "Who are you influenced by?" And we'd say, "Oh, Big Star and Nils Lofgren." You know, his band One Plus One, or his band Grin. That album One Plus One is great, and they just wrinkle their brow because they didn't know what we were talking about. So to discover this whole undercurrent of things, it feels like you're kind of you're in this secret society, you know, it's so much fun to know kind of something that the mainstream hasn't caught on to yet. And John was always great at knowing what was going to be there, what was going to happen. He still is. He'll say to me, "Hey, have you heard that song by such and such? Oh, there's a really cool lyric in that." But it's just harder to find now because there's so much music that it's hard to see the forest for the trees.
The one thing I want to ask you about is the you're avoiding the plane crash.
We're reporting this afternoon on the worst commercial air disaster in United States commercial aviation history. At O'Hare Field, Flight 191, American Airlines, bound for Los Angeles. The account of possible disaster victims ranges from 263 up to 279, some as high as 290.
The band was booked on that flight.
We were booked on that flight, yeah. So we were flying out to L.A. It was Memorial Day weekend, 1979, May 25th, I think it was. And it was American 191. And we were excited because we're thinking, oh, man, record company does not realize it's Memorial Day weekend. We're flying out on Friday. There's not going to be anybody in the office Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday. We got a 4-day paid vacation before we have to do anything in sunny Los Angeles. I mean, come on. And we were all packed and ready to go. And Thursday night, I think our flight was around 1 o'clock in the afternoon, or as I recall, on Friday. Thursday night, they called us and they said, "Look, they realized it. No one's going to be in the office. So we've canceled your flights. And we were furious because we were saying, come on, literally, we got our bags packed. We're at halfway out the door. And that plane went down and killed everybody on board. So we still kind of hold our breath a little bit on every May 25th.
One of the things I like on present tense a lot is the difference specifically between the guitars. And this is where I think the power pop label certainly doesn't fit, because you guys were doing things, at least to my ears, that you had the lighter, jangly kind of, you know, melodic sound, and then you had a crunch and you had a heaviness that you were playing, that riffs were being played over the lighter sounds. And that wasn't really a thing for what people would call power pop. You were combining the light and the heavy, and you did it in a way that made a lot of sense. Like, was that something that you talked about? Say, hey, if I'm going to play light, you come in a little heavy?
Very much so. It's very observant that you bring that up, because I remember in those days, we would say we love the combination of acoustic and electric guitar. And that, but that combination of those, the light and the dark and the heavy and the, that was so interesting to us. And, that's what excited us in music, was it covered so much ground and so many bases. And again, when I said like the Foo Fighters, you hear Dave do something unplugged, it sounds just as powerful as when he does the full band version, because of the way the songs are written and the way he delivers. I mean, he's in the class by himself. What can I say?
Sometimes it's great. You happen upon a mistake, or you just do something and it sounds great. That's awesome. But when you design it that way, I don't know. There's, and it comes out the way that record came out, it's got to be really satisfying. And again, to someone like me, it did pave the way for what came later, because a lot of the rock music or the alternative music, whatever you want to call it, did do and use that balance between light and heavy, you know, the soft intro, the little buildup, you know, bring in the chorus and then kind of go back to start and do it all over again. Yeah. And it worked really, really well. It's one of the first things I noticed when I listened to the record. I was like, wow, I wonder if they really did this on purpose.
Well, thanks for noticing. I mean, and another example of that is on the song Cruel You on the record, there's this guitar that we call the chanky guitar, the clanky guitar. But that guitar on Cruel You, I remember I took this little single speaker Boogie amplifier into this little bathroom in the main house at the manor. And we set it on the toilet, and because it was, you know, how bathrooms have that really reverberant live sound. And we mic'd it, and it was screaming loud. And it was directly below Skip's bedroom. So, and it was just screaming loud, and he was in bed, but he was hard of hearing in one ear, so he always slept on the other ear, and I didn't wake him. But it was just cranking, and I remember at the very end of the song, it was a great memory of doing those kind of little fills that come in during that song, and just sloppy, chanky kind of sound. And I always think of standing in that bathroom next to that amplifier. You know, if you want to hear what that album sounded like, our version of it, what we show the record company, we released a CD called Double Exposure, which is all the demos from those demos, plus all the demos for the second record, Tongue Twister. That's on one CD called, or it's on actually two CDs, I guess. Is it two CDs? I don't even remember now. Anyhow, Double Exposure is the name of that. And then there was a box set that came out in England last year called Electrified, the Electra Years. And that has both the Electra version and our demo version of those songs back to back for all three of the albums that we did with Electra. When you first write a song and record it, it's you're working off this inspiration. It's you know, you know what you want. You hear something, you get an idea, and you get excited and you do it. The second time you do it, you're copying what you had done.
I'm a sucker for demos, and you know, you really get an idea of what the songwriter intended. Because studios, as great as they are, and engineers and producers, like I know you guys did it yourself for the most part, but like sometimes they get reimagined to the point where they're not really what was intended. They may sound great, but it's rare you get the artist's original intention.
Rob, you're right on the money. And, yep. You know, I love that stuff. I love that sense of immediacy.
So do I. So thank you for letting us know that those exist. I'm going to do my best to find them. I'm going to go get them. Yeah.
Cool.
I love your record, and I can't wait to go deeper into Shoes.
Oh, thanks. Thanks a lot. Well, it's been fun, guys. I mean, you know, anything else you need to know, or any question you might have, just let me know.
Will do. Thank you so much, Jeff.
Cool. Thank you very much, guys.
All right, man.
Thanks. Have a good night.
All right. Take care.
Good night.
Bye-bye. The songs you heard on this episode of Abandoned Albums were all taken from the Shoes' 1979 album Present Tense, and they were Too Late, Every Girl, I Don't Miss You, and Cruel You. Present Tense is available to stream wherever you stream your favorite music.
Jeff Murphy's book, Birth of a Band, The Record Deal and the Making of Present Tense, is available at Amazon.com.
Many thanks to Jeff Murphy and the rest of the band.
Thanks to Jess and Jeff from Hyperbubble, who allowed us to use a clip from their documentary, Cowgirls and Synthesizers.
Abandoned Albums was recorded at Thunder Love Studios.
Produced and written by Keith R. Higgins and Rob Janicki.
Engineered and mixed by Steve Beasley. Edited by A.J. Royce.
Original music by Mike Pellegrino. If you like what you've heard, be sure to subscribe and follow us on social media. At Twitter, we are at Abandoned Albums, and on Instagram, we are at Abandoned_Albums.
As always, thanks to Rob Janicki, S.W. Loudon, Nathan Sage, Steve Beasley, Mike Pellegrino, Therina Bella, and of course, our executive producer, Rufus Thunderlove.
And now, until we meet again next time, I remain as always obediently yours.
Abandoned Albums is a production of Station Road, LLC.